This is Screen Divers. On this episode, we are talking about 1989's Joe Dante's The Burbs, starring Tom Hanks, Bruce Dern, Carrie Fisher, Rick Duckerman, Corey Feldman, Corey Dasinger, and Queenie the Poodle. This movie was distributed by Universal Pictures, produced by Imagine Entertainment. It is a phenomenal score by Jerry Goldsmith, which we are going to talk about extensively. And how are you, Steve?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right.
Yeah?
A little bit of...
I'm hungover.
Good for you, man. Literally just
oh, the, no. The yeah. Steve's hungover.
You literally went... You hit
who gives
the
a
31st
shit?
And you were like, yep.
How are you, Ricky?
I'm good. Hello, all.
Mm-hmm. You're in this movie, Ricky. Corey Feldman.
I got really confused because there's two Coreys in this. And I actually thought Corey Feldman changed his name. When I was looking at IMDb, I was like, is it now Corey? What is that? What?
Danziger.
Yeah. Well, is it because I sent you a meme with a picture of Corey Feldman and it said Danzig under it because he needed to look like Danzig?
And so then I was like, Corey Danziger? Oh my, has he changed his... And of course, on IMDb, it is of the Burbs and Corey Danziger is the younger kid standing next to Corey Feldman. So I actually thought he had changed his name.
I don't even know if that kid did anything else after this.
I don't think he did.
Unless I'm a quick look.
Maybe, but you take a look. How many times you got open, Steve?
Six.
He was,
say that
he was
two more times, man. Two more times.
Six. Six. Six.
Ooh, the number of beasts.
Well, let's stay on that for a moment.
Actually, he did do... a fair few bits after this. He did Beethoven.
Who, Bruce Dickinson or Corey Danziger?
Corey Danziger.
Oh, okay, sorry.
And he also Bloodlines, Murder in the Family, TV movie.
Great. Yeah. Who could ever forget?
Seven. Yeah, 1996.
Well, there's one thing to mention here. When we were, I think it was during the David Lynch episode, we were just shooting the shit after recording the show, and Steve, you were in Rome playing with the band.
Yeah.
And we were talking about what to do next week, and, you know, one of us uttered this. I can't remember who, and it doesn't matter, but...
It's probably you.
Possibly. But Ricky's reaction just cemented the fact that we were going to do this, because I know that this is a movie that you would have liked as well. So we made this executive decision without you, Steve. But
no, it's a good executive decision. It's been
executive.
On my watch.
It's executive decision. I can't believe you're starting to sound like Arnie. What the fuck? That's my job, man. But and the other movie that we were going to do, and I said it, and immediately Ricky went, fuck yeah, and you would have done the same, Steve, was Inner Space.
Oh, yeah. Joe Dante.
There you go. I forgot that there was also Joe Dante. Just by looking at that movie, if you watch if you pay attention to the character actors in this, and then because I had to, you know, while I was doing my screen dive, I came across all these character actors peppered throughout Joe Dante's movies. So he is another one of those that likes to work with the same people, and that's great. Yeah. But it took this watch because it completely passed me by. Maybe because there's been a string of movies, like anything from the beginning of it or highlighting the beginning of what Satanic Panic was all about with Late Night with the Devil. Then we had Hysteria.
Yeah,
a very underrated series that people should actually seek. And there's been this revival of Satanic Panic, or at least, you know, we're taking another stab at it. But
quite
I forgot
literally.
That this was on right at the end, on the cusp of the end of it, because 1989, right? So,
yeah.
And that's what this movie is about. I think when I was sourcing a copy for us to watch, Steve, I told you that I came across the work print cut.
Yeah.
And... I mean, you can see that this movie has gone through extensive rewrites because there were three different endings. There was a bunch of stuff.
This is where I'm going to jump in. They couldn't do extensive rewrites.
But before you answer that, Ricky, what's this movie about?
Oh yeah, sorry. let me get there. Sorry, I'll just. So,
do your job.
Imagine a world where you are stuck in the suburbs, as Ray Peterson is. He lives with his wife, his dog, and his son, and nothing is happening until somebody new moves in next door, and Mark Rumsfeld, played by Bruce Dern, decides that they're weird, and so does Art decide they're weird, and Ricky Butler decides they're weird, and from this moment on, they're too weird to be on the suburbs. So they pretty much destroy their lives.
And their house.
that's what this movie is about.
Very early on, and I've probably rewatched this film in the past week about four times. Very early on, it only hit me today that Art goes, oh yeah, their previous house got burnt down.
Yeah.
It got absolutely obliterated. And that's what happened. And again, not because of their fault, but that's what happens at the end of this film, spoiler, that their house gets completely burnt down.
Yeah, it feels like a complete succession of houses being burnt down by their neighbors because they all think they're weird.
They're just too weird. Yeah.
Look, I never put any stock into Corey Feldman's performances. I've always been attracted to them because he was lucky enough to, and he was charming. You know, as a child actor, he was, you know, he was memorable and everything he was in that we remember him from. Then his career took a dive and now he is where he is. I mean, it's, you know, as people being sympathetic towards this fucking stage thing, I think you need to get some therapy. But I'm addressing the person saying that and Corey Feldman. But about him, he does have a great line in this movie, and it's a closer, and it's God, I love this street.
Yeah.
And I it's possibly the reason why this movie resonated so much with us. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs. I assume that you guys have as well.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it is. Like, his entire role throughout the movie, he's just watching it happen, like a show, to the point in which he has a date and he's more preoccupied to providing the... I don't know if they were going to go to the movies with this girl whenever, because she comes over and she goes, oh, what are we doing? And he goes, no, trust me. he puts a couple of chairs on the lawn and they just watch the entire thing. It's... First of all, it doesn't matter. I will never get bored of this movie. Never, ever. And... if you go online and you look at the ratings of this movie, it's got a 56% rating on IMDb or some shit like that. And then it's got a pretty low tomato meter score as well on Rotten Tomatoes. And I don't give a shit. I think a lot of people that... Is it possible that this is like a Marmite, Vegemite situation? Like, I don't even know. I think
because there's so many... I personally, and again, I feel like we're all the same here. There is so many different tonal shifts throughout this film that some people I love it. I love the tonal shift. the director of photography, who has worked on a lot of Spielberg movies, Robert M. Stevens, said that...
Oh, my God, I didn't mention him at the beginning. You're right. Robert Stevens is in there. He's a DP. Yeah,
he got this job by mistake because the guy that normally works with Joe Dante. Was on another project. And so Spielberg pretty much said, yeah, you should go with Robert. And Robert's like, cool. So, yeah.
Nice one. And I'm going to tell you something else about that. While we're watching the movie, there's a bunch of like rain scenes and everything. And I turned around to Steve and I went, holy shit, that looks like real rain. And I said, this is not a set. It's not a set. It's got to be a neighborhood somewhere. Like, it's going to be a cul-de-sac somewhere. It's a fucking set.
Yeah, and it's a famous set as well. Steve kept saying that.
And I'm like, nah, I'm ignoring you.
I tell you what. You were right. Sally and I had a discussion about this because we've visited the Warner Brothers Studios and we've visited one of these actual sets. The set at Warner Brothers Studios, you've seen it mainly in things like Gilmore Girls and a few other things. One thing is Lost Boys. You know the church in Lost Boys?
Yeah.
That was on the Warner Brothers set. So middle of this green, on the opposite side, is just the front of a church. And, you know, they just shoot all around it. Maxine. Maxine uses the Universal Studio sets,
yeah,
including this one.
Coronial Street, and, it's called, yeah.
Yeah.
The set's called Coronial Street.
Yeah.
And we've seen also, it in a thousand things, by the way.
And uses All America Avenue, which is the Warner Brothers one. So Maxine was basically split across two different studios and just filmed both of them.
Very cool.
What I was going to say was that the, I'm sure the you
writing.
Guys
have, you were talking about the writing, I interrupted
I
you
was
earlier.
Talking about the writing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this was done in 88, and during 88 there was a writer's strike.
Strike, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
so because of the writer's strike, they couldn't actually employ Dana Oslin on set. So there couldn't be rewrites. There couldn't be. And things like when they had to change the ending, they did that on – they couldn't write down how they were changing the ending. They kind of had to verbalize it and kind of do storyboards, but they couldn't actually – they weren't allowed to write it down or at least get a writer in. This is why at the end, Dana Olsen actually does have – a cameo as one of the actors, so he's on set as an actor. And during that time, that's when Joe Dante said, okay, tell me how can we have a different ending, because it didn't test well, so let's have another ending. So this is how they got
we won't
tell anybody. Well, I'm paying you as an actor, but let's reboot the ending right now. Yeah.
Clever, clever. I skipped a couple of things at the beginning, but that's all right. There's no fucking formula here. This movie cost $80 million to make. It made money, okay? Because the box office was about $50 million, so that's profitable. So it was watched by a lot of people. I mean, I guess that had star power required for this to work. Also, one of the producers was Ron Howard, and it's worth mentioning because, you know, he was already weaving magic here.
Yeah.
I think these are all important influences on why this movie works. Because when this movie is funny, it's really funny. Not only that, it's 101 minutes, and that's an important thing that we are going to keep stating whenever we review a movie, the running time, because it's on the sweet spot.
Yeah.
All right? It's really,
the right amount of time.
Yeah. Again, why the fuck are we making movies that are 2 hours and 40 minutes? Make a TV series if that's what you need to do. There are many things to talk about, but one of them is a theory, because I heard somebody, then I went on Reddit, then there's a couple of theories, and you know what? Let's put this one on the table right away, and then we'll talk about the funniest sequences in this movie. Due to the fact that there were, you know, scenes taken out, the entire Satanic Panic angle is only touched in that sequence when there's, you know, you're chanting, and it's got the manuscript and whatever, and then that's dropped. All right, there's no more references to that, but there was more. In the work print cut, there was much more. They were even Bruce Dern's character, what's his name, in this. What's his name?
Mark
and his wife, they put on robes and stuff in the work print, you know, robes with a pentagram on it. There's, you know, they doubled down on all of this, and it seems that they kind of left that angle. But another thing that I don't even know if this was implied, when we see Art the first time in this movie, he's got a rifle, he's shooting birds in the neighborhood, right? Then he's the one who's continuously kind of pushing Ray to go after this, right? He's the one who's like continuously, not to mention the fact that he has a massive lack of impulse control. When he goes to his house,
it's genius.
Man, I'm telling you, and this is coming from someone who understands that. He's sitting at the table, he eats his breakfast, then he gets seconds, then he eats the eggs that are left over, then he goes to the fridge, he takes out ribs, and he keeps eating, right? And he does this all the way through. It shows that he has zero impulse control. Like there's something that hits him, in like an idea hits him, and he goes for it right away. So he's the one that pushes for all this absurd stuff. Yes, obviously it doesn't help to have the situation being, you know, further inflamed by a PTSD dude that lives next door, which, by the way, it's not even like granted that we have to give for granted that he served, because I'm not so sure if he did.
No,
he's older, he may have served, right? Because he's still lifting up the flag in his lawn, he's doing all of this shit. But there's one thing he talks about, the fact that his wife has gone away, Art's wife's gone away. Okay, we never see her. There's one cut of the movie apparently where we see her in the end.
Yeah,
I can't remember if.
Well, we saw it in the end of the version we saw. Okay. She's wearing the pink dress or red dress.
Yeah, you see it for a moment, right? Yeah, you see it for a moment. But the idea in there was because there were three original endings. There was one where you didn't see any of this, and there's a story that Art tells Ray about Skip, the serial killer. He tells him the story in detail. Like, he knows a lot of stuff about this. Plus, his wife's away. There's very, very little mentioning of this throughout the movie without the ending that we saw. And another thing is when Ray's having the dream, there's a dream sequence in this, and the guy that plays Skip in the dream is also Art.
Yeah.
You know, so it would have been much greater if it turned out to be that, yes, Dr. Klopek was doing something shady, but at the end of the day, you could have had that all the bodies that they were digging out were bodies that Skip buried.
Yeah.
So there is that angle as well that, you know, that Art is the serial killer next door. And that would have been funny as well, because you never know what the fuck you live next to.
No, that's especially the in the burbs.
Yeah, in the suburbs. You never know, you know, like, man, we live down the street from what was the name of that serial killer that lived here in London, or one of many, from Scotland? Des?
Des, Mary would be the one to pick this up. The guy who basically shoved all the bodies in the...
Oh, he was horrific.
Yeah.
For our American listeners, if Des serial killer, will do a search for you, because it makes for a great show.
I'm doing it now.
Yeah. So if you don't know anything about this guy...
Dennis Nielsen,
and
his
nickname was Des. You can even start by watching. There's a series. It's like a mini series, like six episodes or whatever, with David Tennant playing him, and he's horrifying in it.
One called Des.
Des, and it's and that's it. We live three streets away from where the guy lived. Like, obviously, right after watching the show, we went in front of the house and everything. Like, it's, but it's a possibility. You know, it's a possibility. So that's one horror, right? That's one horrific aspect of all of this. But if you live in a cul-de-sac, you've got the dream, you've got the lawn, you've got the little house and everything. But all the houses around you look pretty much the same. People just start wondering what your life is like, and you have very little privacy. If not any at all. Like, in fact, you know, as much as there's camaraderie, whenever you see them in the evening, you know, they're talking to each other, live next to each other. I don't know, man. I don't know about being that neighborly. It's to me, it's a bit of a nightmare, actually, to be honest.
But in a way, I think that's why Dana Olsen then evolved the characters into these boyish, like, preteens who are like, hey, can Ray come and play today? It's in the script that they are being these like little mischievous kids of the neighborhood, that they are the like 10-year-old boys who are like, hey, come and we'll go play some ball, but really what they're doing is going into the creek and pulling out a dead squirrel and being like, isn't that gross? And that's what they're doing.
Dude, that's all well and good when we were kids. Like, I grew up in a cul-de-sac like that. Like, it's when you're a kid, that's great. That's the Goonies. That's great.
Yeah.
But as an adult, put a gun in your mouth, man.
I think that's the juxtaposition that this film's meant to be doing.
Of course, suburban nightmare. That's what this is.
But not only suburban nightmare, but you know, these guys, one is just stay at home because he's a war veteran or whatever he is. Another one is like, basically, the wife's not here, so I'm going to waste as much time at home as possible. And the third one, which is Ray, which doesn't actually get communicated in the film, but it was in the script.
Ray lost his job.
Yeah,
that's why they're arguing at the beginning. Yeah, you're right. That's interesting.
So that's three men who are stuck in their cul-de-sac, who have got nothing better to do but to create a fantasy, a boyish fantasy about the weird house down the road.
You said it as well. You said boyish. Like, Tom Hanks looks much younger than his age here. Like, he's 33. He's the only one. Everyone else looks older than their age. If you look at Carrie Fisher, she was also 33.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, I thought, oh, shit, she looks older than him here. I don't know why, but it's possibly that it's also the performances.
It's also
because she's much more mature.
Yeah. The haircut.
The wig.
Yeah.
She wearing a wig?
She was wearing a wig.
I wasn't looking at her wig.
No, but the funny thing is...
neither was Steve, to be honest. Yeah. But the funny thing Steve, is, you want to come clean about something?
One of two childhood crushes.
Yeah, of course. And it was probably after Return of the Jedi, right?
For our listeners, before recording, because I was late. Ricky, can you please tell me what the conversation that you two were having before we started recording this episode?
Oh, we were talking about the Star Wars toys acquirements that Steve had gotten for $20 this week.
Was he showing you toy by toy?
He was
collectible
showing me...
after collectibles. Let's not call them toys. Not toys. No. They're collectibles. Okay.
The classic Slave One, which was flown by Boba Fett, Millennium Falcon, TIE Bomber, X-Wing, a couple other bits and pieces.
So keep talking about these crashes, man. I want you to sleep on the couch tonight. Please, tell us. So what was the other one?
Was it from Return or was it from the whole trilogy?
I think it's just the entire trilogy. Yeah. Strong female character, mate. That's what we want in movies, strong female characters.
Yeah, I'm sure for me,
Return.
But as a child, I'm sure that that's what attracted you to Leia. You're the worst. We were watching the movie. He was literally drooling. Like,
I met her at one of the Star Wars cons.
Yep.
And I got a signature and I got her to sign my Slave Leia box.
Oh, very nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
Did she enjoy that?
Did she sign Leia's box? Is that what you said?
Yeah. The Slave Leia's box.
So, she just said, oh, you're one of them.
Dude, so let's stay on the cast as well. I mean, she's very good looking. Like, she looks so radiant in this as well. Yeah. But about Rick Dukeman, the guy that plays Art, right? First of all, he's dead. I didn't realize that. And then I looked at his career. It looked to me like he was doing fine. And then something kind of he lost himself a little bit.
Well, according to Joe Dante and a few other of the production staff, it was actually more of a, I'm sick of Hollywood, I'm going back to stand-up.
Fair enough.
And it's funny, when we were talking about this prior, I said I always confuse him with Dan Aykroyd.
Mate, we spent the entire movie questioning, like, first of all, he can sell the bullshit just like Aykroyd. There's an entire bit in which he sells, like, the implausible, he just sells it so well. And there's that kind of motto mouth way of doing it.
I also said John Candy.
Between the two.
Okay, so you've picked three 80s originally stand-up comedians
who
then got bigger doing smaller roles in TV work and then hit a movie career. So, and Rick Dukeman also was in another film called Little Monsters with... I've just forgotten his name. He's got a podcast. Mandel?
Howie Mandel?
The shaven head guy. Howie Mandel.
Isn't he the American Idol guy? You could have just said that. Like.
Yeah, but I forgot his name.
Okay.
Anyway. But anyway, he was
in Scary Movie. He was in Jury Duty. He was in Last Action Hero. He was in Loaded Weapon.
He was in
Groundhog Day. So
my point was that there was this bunch of Canadian comedians that all came up at the same time.
He's Canadian as well?
Yep, he's Canadian as well.
I knew it. Okay.
There you go. Okay. Which is why he has that intonation.
Yeah, yeah, but he's hilarious. He's hilarious in this. The movie wouldn't have been the same without him. But we did say at one point, like, they probably wanted to cast Aykroyd in this, and he would have done well.
Yeah.
You know, he probably turned it down because I think he was probably... about to do Ghostbusters 2. I can't remember when Ghostbusters 2 came out, but...
But he was...
85? When was Ghostbusters 2?
It's about 5 years later, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, he was doing other stuff.
I think Dragnet came pretty soon after... Oh, 96?
Dragnet was before this. 96, which, by the way, that entire set was also used in Dragnet. That's why we've seen it in 10,000
1989 was Ghostbusters 2.
Oh, there you go.
Well, there so you go. Definitely, yeah. It was. Dude, yeah. I was just guessing that, but that's, you know, that's plausible. Very plausible. Yeah. Man, I don't know if you want to stay on the cast, but there's another thing as well. Like, there's another one, Dick Miller, who's not like now. Dick Miller and Robert Picardo,
garbage men in this.
Yeah, yeah. First of all, as soon as they come on screen, like we looked at each other. Steve knew already. Like, holy shit, Voyager. But then it's funny that I looked at Dick Miller's, like, okay, if you look at Dick Miller's career, he's been in everything we've ever watched.
Oh, my God.
Like,
yeah.
That's why he looks so familiar. I wrote some of the stuff that he was in Terminator, down. He was in That Great 2000. He was in 1941. He was in The Howling. Yes, Steve. He was in Terminator.
Gremlins.
He was in Gremlins. He was in Chopping Mall. He was in After Hours. He was in Night of the Creepers. Like, he's got at least...
So how many of those are Joe Dante?
A lot of them.
Oh, a lot of them are Joe Dante.
A lot of them are Joe Dante.
My
as well.
Favorite one is Matinee. I love Matinee.
Oh, with John Goodman. Yeah, that's a great movie,
and
dude.
Dick Miller plays the guy who comes in and is basically like saying how horrible the movie is and like picketing it and all this stuff. But he gets paid by John Goodman's character to do it, to create a buzz. And Dick Miller just knows what he has to do. He just comes on set, plays a garbage man, gets really irate about, I pick up garbage from the cans, not from the floor. You know, he just comes in and does it. That scene is important, dude. Yeah.
That scene is important because normally you would have someone cleaning that up, whatever. If you watch the rest of the movie, the garbage
is still there.
It's where they left it.
And I have to say, both from another Joe Dante film, Robert Picardo and Dick Miller are also in Explorers, which is one of my childhood favorites.
Both of them are.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's another Dante film.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember Robert Picardo as the cowboy.
In space. He was so good.
He's in his underwear, dude. With cowboy boots.
Yeah.
And I remember he was ripped or something. Like, he looked fucking jacked.
He must have been told, you are definitely going to just be in your underwear for the scene. So he's
crunch.
Oh, both of them are hilarious in this. And it's just a little cameo. But, dude, there is one sequence in this. We watched it twice because it was so fucking good. It's the entire standoff thing. As Ray and Art are standing outside of the Klopex house, and they're trying to, you know, muster the courage of going to talk to them. Dude, there are two Ennio Morricone tracks in this, and they are placed perfectly.
Yeah.
The tracks in question are from, I looked, the first one is from a movie, it was called Se Sei Qualcuno. No, the name of the track was Se Sei Qualcuno è Colpa Mia, which means, if you ask somebody, it's my fault. And that's from My Name is Nobody.
Yes, My Name is Nobody.
Now,
yep.
My Name is Nobody, the director of that was a guy called Tonino Valeri. And Tonino Valeri, it's someone that people don't remember because Il Mio Nome Nessuno, which was My Name is Nobody with Terence Hill, was his, you know, greatest achievement as a director. But he was the assistant director for Leone.
Oh.
He was the assistant. So that track is Joe Dante paying respects to Leone because there was a connection. So he used a song from another movie, but guess what? Tonino Valeri was the assistant director in Fistful of Dollars. He was assistant director in For a Few Dollars More. And everything, him and Goldsmith worked so well together, man. Like, this movie would not be the same. Because I'm pretty sure that was Jerry Goldsmith's choice.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, I'll do the score, but this sequence requires that.
This is from the scriptwriter's mouth. What actually happened was Goldsmith tried to do a Morricone. And three or four attempts, they were like, it's not quite there. And finally, Joe Dante was like, you know what? We'll just pay for it.
Just put it in there.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And the other track is from, which is famous, which is the Sundown, Il Tramonto. Yeah. And that's by, I think it's the close-up sequences as well. These two tracks keep coming on anyway. At different times, but the entire close-ups of the eye paying homage to Leone, even the poodle,
the poodle,
it's hilarious. And then there's another punchline hitting so much harder because of this, because we're already laughing at that, but there's also tension building up. And then when they get to the door, Art goes through the fucking floorboard. That joke hits twice in this movie, dude.
Yeah.
Because it happens to Mark's character later as well. He goes, fuck the brownies or whatever he says. Yeah.
Damn brownies. And the funny thing is, isn't the floor already fixed by the time they show up again? So there's like no hole previously, so you can't get a little reminder. So, but another part, they fall straight through, yeah.
Yeah. There's another thing I noticed this on this view, and I told Steve as well as we're watching it. And you know how Tarantino continuously is paying homage to everything. Well, he does in Pulp Fiction to this movie, dude. He does. Because there's a sequence in which Mark is putting out the two of them. They're wearing shorts, they're wearing t-shirts, dressed the same way as Vincent Vega and Jules are. And he's hosing them down.
And they're on the lawn. On the floor.
And it's no surprise that it's Bruce Dern doing this, because then Bruce Dern goes on to be in The Eightful Eight as the racist general. Is it a general or a colonel or whatever the fuck he was?
Colonel.
Do you remember the sequence in question, right? When he's hosing them down.
Basically, they get hosed down because they're still covered in blood from the non-execution scene within the car.
Yeah. AKA the bees in this. Yeah. But
the bees!
Not the bees!
Not the bees!
Also, the nine, the what is it, the 669, which is the number of the club exiles that gets knocked to a six.
Yeah, so perfect. I think that's also another reason why people kind of go a little bit weird with this film in terms of not rating it high or just being like, I didn't quite get it, is that there are playful, almost... hold on.
What is this? Was ist das?
That was a Tamagotchi. I'll start again. I think this is why...
what the fuck? You got a Tamagotchi?
Yes. Yes,
don't you have real children to keep alive at the moment?
I know. So my children also start Tamagotchis, and they don't care about them. But
so
I
you're
do.
Keeping them alive.
I care about every digital one of them. Anyway,
mate, this conversation is a vasectomy.
That's what this is.
Thank you very much.
Oh, whatever. What digital thing that do you keep alive? Think about it.
Myself,
and then tell me in 2 minutes.
I feed myself very well, and I feed Anne. That's all I need to do, and I feed our friends. Yeah. I overfeed our friends. That's it.
Yeah,
that's
you do overfeed
there's probably
your friends.
A game on your
Thank
phone,
you.
Or there's a game that you visit every single day, but let's not go there.
No.
So back to what I was saying.
Yes.
This film probably gets rated a little bit middly because there are too many moments in it that are a little bit... on the goofy Looney Tunes side. And we know Joe Dante is a huge fan of Looney Tunes because he did 100%. Looney Tunes Back in Action, as well as Gremlins 2 has Bugs Bunny. And
there's a lot of slapstick in this movie because of that as well.
And even Explorers has Looney Tunes in the TV screens.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Steve, do you remember the cereal?
Yeah.
There's a Gremlin cereal in the kitchen counter, on the kitchen counter. And the Freakies?
Freakies was the other one. Yeah, I can't find a reference to Freakies.
Well, Freakies was made for it to an extent that actually. So you were talking about the work print before.
Yeah,
I've actually sat through the work print.
You did? It looks like it's shot on VHS, mate. Like,
Well, because probably the only copy was a VHS that they still had of it that they couldn't be bothered to like clean up. But the
some scenes work, some scenes don't. Right? It's.
The thing about the work print is that actually the film is essentially the same. It's that there's about seven scenes that are slightly different, including the ending.
Yeah, it's actually an extra seven and a half minutes or something, by the way. Something
about
like that.
Seven and a half minutes. You mentioned about the Bruce Dern in the cloak and all that stuff. That's the dream sequence is extended by about 4 minutes. And So
that's
not
necessary.
It's not necessary, which is why we have the theatrical cut. But we'll talk more about the ending in a moment.
Mm.
What I want to talk about are the three huge stars of this movie that always get just seen as the weirdos. But without them, this film wouldn't hit as hard as it should.
I agree.
Klopax. They're amazing. All three of them are so good at what they're doing, which is barely anything, but so good at it.
Henry Gibson takes the cake, dude. Oh, yeah, I've seen that guy in so many. I have him in the same compartment. He's on the same shelf in my brain as Udo Kier.
Udo Kier.
100%.
As in, make me bad, licking up, what's her name?
I love him, dude. He's so memorable. Every time he's on screen, he's super memorable. And German, for whatever reason. But it's like, very.
Actually, if I had the comedy for Christmas, when we were making our decisions, I would have put you guys through Surviving Christmas. And Udo Kier has an amazing scene in Surviving Christmas where he plays a very Germanic photographer that takes advantage of Catherine O'Hara.
Okay. about Henry Gibson, you sent us a video of him and
two videos.
Goldie Hawn, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, for our listeners, go look at it. Look for it. What was
it was from Laugh-In. So he used to be one of the main cast of Laugh-In, which there's a Simpsons episode where they kind of do a bit of a, like, the Simpsons tried to do their own, like, comedy stand-up show, and it's basically Laugh-In. So it had a lot of guest stars poking their heads through saying, hey, and doing terrible jokes. He does a dance sequence with Goldie Hawn when Goldie Hawn was, like, 20-something.
Yeah.
And it's so...
It's bizarre, yeah. It's bizarre. Wendy Shaw, dude. Obviously, you know, as a kid, I had like a massive crush on her, just like everyone in this movie. Every man in this movie has a crush on her. And then I remember that she's the voice of
the wife in American Dad. Yeah.
Francine.
She's Francine's voice in American Dad. And she's perfect. Absolutely perfect. You were saying, we were talking about the ratings of this and how people perceive this. I have never met anyone that doesn't have this as one of their favorite movies. But this kind of gives credit to our taste in people, because I don't give a shit. I don't hang out. Like, you know what I mean? I don't tend to hang out with people that don't like this movie. So that's, if anything, like, even in the Friends of Horror Weekly group, there's a lot of American listeners. There's a lot of people that live in the U.S. Our hearts are going to you, by the way. I'm really sorry about what you're going through. Find solace in knowing that very soon we will all be going through this, because if it continues this way, it'll just take over the world. There'll be another conflict. We are not far from it. So your suck will soon
Everyone's
be our
played
suck.
Fallout, right? Everyone knows how to
Everyone's
play
Fallout. Everyone's played
Fallout.
So, yeah, we'll get in there. Oh, my God. Anyway, so, yeah, and there's a, you know, if I can, in the group, I always post something funny just to bring some levity to the group, because they're going through the shit at the moment. I've never met anyone that didn't like this movie. If anything, everyone has a childhood memory attached to this. You know, a slumber party or whatever, and this was a movie of choice. Or this is also Halloween. It's on heavy rotation for Halloween for a lot of people.
Okay, so I'm just going to admit, this is the first time I've seen it since 1993. so last week was the first time I've seen it again since 1993. I've got fond memories of watching it, and but I don't think I took a lot of I didn't take it in at the time. I just thought it was a fun movie, and it's been on my watch list for a while, but I just haven't got around to it.
You took it in at my place on.
Yeah.
I just wanted you to say yes to that.
I took it in at your place. I also took in some of the sound effects for a folio, which was done because we've got a really nice Star Wars Easter egg in there.
Steve, pick that up. You tell us, man.
We were sitting there on the couch, and I went, Oh,
yeah.
So
I had to play it again, and then I heard it as well.
Yeah, we get the actual Skywalker hyperdrive failure, which is based on the inertia starter of a 1928 U.S. Army biplane, which the sound design was created by Ben Burtt.
It sounds like a turbine stalling, basically. We heard it as, you know, the Millennium Falcon doing that. We heard it in The Mandalorian as well. It's a particular sound. Maybe I'll throw it in this episode at some point. I got to find it.
Steve has brought up a good thing. We have not talked about this film in our history. We normally do that. We normally talk about
it. And that's why I wanted to bring it up.
Yeah.
Okay, you wanna go first, Ricky?
Me, so I know it's an 80s horror film from 89 when it got released in the UK. I didn't get to see this until it hit like Sky. I saw this in sort of parts again when I was much younger. But then when I sat down to watch it, I loved it. And, you know, the scene with the femur, femur bone, that scene has stuck in my psyche for a long time. And probably the first time I saw it was an edited version on British TV, because all they had to do for British TV was remove some of the swear words, but then also remove just a section of the horror films, including the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Well, I think they replaced it with something else.
No, they just cut it out, and you just heard the screams. I remember seeing it on TV, and they would have put it on during the day because, you know, the UK are okay as long as you, like, cover up the swearing and remove certain scenes. But I bought the Arrow film, the Arrow Blu-ray, when it first got released. So that was 2016.
They really did justice from, it's a nice cleanup from the Shout Factory release that came before. Yeah.
We've got to say this, like companies like Arrow are bringing back classics to what we should be seeing. You know, it's great.
Criterion as well, dude.
Criterion. The collection. Yeah. Arrow. Fantastic.
In Australia, Umbrella, Imprint, all of these people, and who knows who's originally like changing these from 2K to 4K, but these things in these companies in these territories are bringing them back to the masses. Amazing.
Yeah, it's great.
So when I got the Arrow release, sat down with Sally and I said, if you haven't seen The Burbs, we're watching it tonight. Watch it. And when we first moved into our suburban house in Australia, that was the first film we sat down to watch.
Excellent.
It's perfect instance to watch it.
Oh, my God.
Steve?
Yeah. So, as I said, I didn't watch it as in the cinema.
It's a video store rental, right?
It was a video store rental, and I can tell you exactly which video store it was, because I watched it with a friend of mine, Chris Wheel. Again, on a street with identical houses, our school grounds behind us, and it was a little tiny video shack. I think it was called the Video Shack, where we used to just go in, and the guy behind the counter, I'm going to admit this now, he rented us so many movies we shouldn't have seen.
Well, look, I think it was 1989 it was before. I think it was at a friend's place. It was big. It must have been big at a friend's place. I'm talking about the first time I got in contact with Tom Hanks. Because as a kid, you're kind of, you know, you gravitated, you know, as a Gen X Xennial, you kind of gravitated towards this movie. We all did at the same time. But in my case, it was, you know, it was home video first. And then what really drove it home, so it was big or something like that. And then what really drove it home is I went to the movies without telling my parents. And I caused myself a lot of trouble for this. Like, I did this twice. The first time I got in trouble and then did it again. I think the first time was Critters 2 or some shit. And like, I think I put my hand in my mom's purse for that one. So I got in trouble for two things. But but another time, the movie I went to see was Turner and Hooch. I don't know if you remember that. With Tom Hanks and the dog. I loved that movie when I was a kid. And I think let me take a look. That was 89 as well. Turner and Hooch is 89. And I think after that, I went to the video store. And when I went to the video store, I remember seeing, like, a year later, within the year or whatever, seeing The Burbs and watching it. So I took it in like at 14, something like that, you know, 13, 14 years old, whatever it was. So that's why I didn't pick up on the subtext or a few things, like the suburban nightmare of the way an adult would perceive it. I didn't pick up on that until this viewing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I always loved this. Absolutely always loved this. There's a fan of the show, Neil Rickman. We absolutely need to mention Neil, all right? He was pleading with us in going easy on this movie, possibly without him realizing that we all love this movie. But also, he asked us to not forget Queenie, or mentioning Queenie, actually. And he did. You know, he reminded us as well that Queenie the Poodle was Buffalo Bill's dog in Silence of the Lambs.
Put the lotion on its
man in the basket.
I have to say, Queenie was in Batman Returns as well. Which
yes.
Is
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, she was in tons of stuff.
She caught the batarang, right?
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah, yep. We did talk about we did talk about that scene. Worth mentioning as well to you, Steve, that I was right about the Klopik's car. I checked. Oh, it was a Pontiac Catalina. Dog.
Nice.
Yes.
And I said, watching the movie, Lincoln?
That? You said it was a Lincoln, yeah.
Yeah.
Nah.
Is that a Lincoln?
No.
So earlier I mentioned the Klopek.
Yeah.
The Klopeks.
Yeah.
Let's go back to them. I know we talked about
Wait a second. We're on the car now.
And I'm sorry.
Our listeners are probably picturing me being like really fucking fat and huge and or a paraplegic because I don't like to walk, okay? But when we saw, you're a piece of shit. You know that. first of all, I'm not fat. I'm pleasantly.
No. We're talking about the walking bit.
Walking bit.
Okay. Well, I don't like to walk, and I don't like to walk to the extent in which he was laughing at the car fucking coming out of the garage just to take the garbage out, and I was like, that's great, man. That's why I would do that. I totally would do that. And then the entire sequence in reverse as well. I love that. Now, Ricky, what did you want to say?
Well, actually, funnily enough, that scene actually happened to Dana Olsen, the writer. His dad used to pick him up from his mate's house down the road in the car. And he thought,
fantastic.
Yeah, like... My dad, like, why not put something in the film about that? Like dropping off trash at the end of your driveway only to come back in.
Nice one.
But yeah, the Klopek, the one that, of course, we've talked a little bit about Henry Gibson. Courtney Gaines was previously Children of the Corn, which is why he got this role. But who is slated as Brother Theodore, whose real name is Theodore Gottlieb? He is pretty much an unknown because most of his work is theater work. And before we started this podcast, I was looking at his interviews on the David Letterman show.
Is that the guy that gets called Pinocchio at the end?
No, that's Courtney Gaines.
Oh, Courtney Gaines, okay.
Theodore is the get off my car.
Rube.
Yeah, Ruben.
Yeah, okay.
So he used to just do theater productions where he used to do that same character on the theater, and it's proper, always intense, and he's always like that. And supposedly when the cameras turn off, he's a lovely guy. But the reason why he delivers things in such a way, including like the car was there all day, that sort of thing, you know, is because he was completely deaf in his left ear. So that's the only way he could make sure that he was at a right pitch or right volume over intensifying his last couple of words.
Man, the entire sequence with the pretzels and the
sardines.
I said to Steve, I'm going to start serving that shit on game night. Like, oh.
Did you do it?
Absolutely amazing.
Tom Hanks really did that on set. That was all real. There weren't any cuts or anything. Straight in the mouth.
Nothing harrowing, dude. It's 13s and it's a strange pairing. Dude, there's channels on YouTube of people fucking eating horrible shit for hours. When it comes down to the dynamic between men and women and the way they are portrayed in this, like if you look at the way, what is it, Mark, Art and Ray approach this, it's like straight away, fucking take action, go to war, we got to do this, we got to do, which is insane. It's like everyone is Walter from The Big Lebowski. But it's exactly what we would have done.
Oh my God, what are we doing now? We got to do something.
Like, yeah. And then there's the approach of, you know, Wendy Schultz's character and Carrie Fisher's character, which is, let's just go meet them. Let's just go to the house. And so, yeah, from that dynamic as well, is very true. Absolutely. Yeah. Like, that's the approach.
And the whole, that classic line of, like, oh, this is a lovely woman and all this stuff when they go and meet them. And he's like, in the frame, it came in the frame. She just came in the frame. And it's just like, the awkwardness is so brilliant.
Man, there's a ton of one-liners in this. I've got a couple of favorite ones. One of them is, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to watch television. That's a great one. Have you got a favorite one-liner in this? Any of you?
It's got to be, for me, it's got to be the femur. Like, This is a femur, you know. This is no chicken bone, you know. This is a human size femur. You know what that is? A leg bone.
Rick Douglas,
the little song about Satan.
Yeah. That the entire chanting sequence, like, once they get in your head, you're chanting.
Satan's your friend. Satan's your pal.
Listen to yourself. You're chanting.
So we mentioned Imagine earlier. Did anybody catch the Howard on set?
Oh, I didn't see him. Was he? Oh my God. Sorry, I'm just having a little bit of a... Was he with a fireman later on?
No, so not. It wasn't actually Ron Howard.
Howard the Duck? Are you talking about Howard the Duck?
No, not Howard the Duck.
No, okay. No. Hey, there's connections.
Ron Howard's dad, Rance Howard, who is an actor in his own right, was the detective who was like downsizing everybody at the end. He was like speaking into everyone's face, being like, it's a Rance Howard. So there was a Howard on set. So that must have been that Ron was also there as well. But yeah.
Probably was a producer. Yeah, so, well, there you go. Yeah.
Right, let's talk about the ending, okay? So we've already mentioned that there were several endings to this film. The original script ending was going to be that Ray was going to be in a ambulance and driven off by the Klopex. And that was it. And at most, you would cut to Carrie Fisher's character, and she would say, I haven't heard anything from the hospital about Ray, and then it'd, like, cut, sort of thing. When they found out they had Tom Hanks on board, none of the studios wanted to kill Tom Hanks at the end of the film. So that's where they had to like start coming up with options for different endings. And they came up with options for different endings in 1987. So when the writer's strike came, they already had like three or four options to film.
Gotcha.
One of those was the one we've seen as part of the theatrical cut. The one on the work print is actually very similar, but a little slower, where they explain way too much, to a point that Henry Gibson's character says something along the line. It's a great speech. I love the speech. It's something like, you know, moving to suburbia is not what it's meant to be. You know, all you have to do is like paint your house pink or have the wrong car or kill a few people and people start calling you weird. Love that. I wish that was still in the normal thing, but it then started going on a bit like the theatrical cut. Other cuts included that in the trunk of the car were going to be cheerleaders that were about to be killed. Another one was that the garbage men were going to be in the back of the car and just be like these random victims coming up. So they ended up going with the ending that they did just because it had more action.
It's also the ending that worked best. Out of whatever you just mentioned. So
especially because he's already collecting skulls.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of mentioned in that one scene anyway.
Did you guys pick up that during the struggle between Dr. Klopek and Ray in the ambulance? I didn't point it out to Steve because I wanted to keep it to myself for this episode. As they are fighting, there's one sequence in which it's obvious that you see it's Dr. Klopek is basically trying to inject him with this fluid. So you see this huge needle, you know, it was meant to be representing threat as well, besides what's inside the syringe. But there's another one in which, you know, going over the line, like we were talking about the face-off episode, when you shoot something from a different angle and it's a different take and it doesn't look the same, the needle's gone. Because it's very close to Tom Hanks' face. And obviously they had to act this up. So it's just a syringe without a needle. It's like, I noticed that on this viewing. Guys, it's very difficult to talk about a classic of this magnitude. Again, who gives a shit about the IMDb rating or the Rotten Tomatoes? Again, I have never met anyone that didn't like this movie. And I'm pretty sure that you'll struggle. You'll struggle to think of a conversation you had about this movie with someone that, you know. But then, would you even have that conversation with a person that dislikes this movie or doesn't remember it, maybe? I think it's ratings time.
I'm going to give it a big 7.5. And it's almost an 8 for me. It's almost an 8. I think there are some parts which are kind of drop it, that just that little fraction, whereas the pacing goes a little bit out. But I always, when I say always, from a second time of watching this, it's still a fun movie. It's one of those things I could remember from my youth. I could remember it quite well. Mainly because of Carrie Fisher.
So what is it? It's a 7.5, you said, yeah?
7.5.
7.5 what?
Skulls in the trunk of a car.
Okay. That's okay. Okay.
What? I stole it from
Is it stolen? Yeah. Have you stolen
no, something? No. Your right? Yeah, you piece of shit. It's usual. Like, damn it.
Well, I might steal another one, so just wait for it. Okay,
Ricky,
I always say if it's a film that I'm gonna rewatch, it has to be a 7 and above. Yeah. This is easily 8.6 out of 10 for me.
Wow,
my God, I have watched this film. One thing we haven't talked about was the almost cage-like acting that Hanks does, especially when he's like, I'm trying to sleep here. Can't you see I've got my eyes closed? You know, there is
was
so
it, was
much.
Was it the bee sequence?
Not the bees!
Not the bees!
But like, everybody is having so much fun on this, and you can tell that there's probably a...
Actually, you're right. Is a very cage quality about even when he's obviously, you know, he's frustrated by the fact that his wife is right about everything she's saying to him.
Yep.
There's that bit when they're sitting at the table and his snappy kind of demeanor is very cage like.
Yeah, and it's like it goes from 0 to 100 all the time throughout the film, and it's so funny. Even like them looking at the this is a human bone, and it does the zoom ins way too long. It's so enjoyable. I cannot wait to show this to my kids. You know, it's definitely an 8.6 out of 10 for me. There's also I can go into like cinematography and all of this stuff. There's so much going on. The cinematographer said that like to begin with, everything was eye level, and then as it went more and more into a horror film, they started lowering the camera so that you'd get the horror-esque shots. There's so much about this film that is so much fun. So I'm giving it an 8.6 out of 10. Empty beer cans being crushed randomly in people's faces.
Excellence. Pure excellence. Is it my turn?
It is.
Oh,
it is. Come on. Do it.
I love this movie. This is an 8.5 for me. I will decide what that 8.5 is. The unit of measure I will use at the end of my deliberation. I don't think that there would be anything along the likes of Family Guy or American Dad. And you know what? I was thinking about that today, and then I looked up something. Guess what? guess who's making a TV show based on the Burbs? Seth MacFarlane.
Okay.
So, and you have Wendy Shaw that ended up in being one of the leads in another one of his shows. So, you know, I mean, it's obvious. It is obvious because there's a very, this movie shines when you have those little kind of sketches. You know, it's when it, Steve mentioned the flagging a little bit in the second act, I think in particular, there is some flagging. It's true. And it's because the movie needs to have a plausible narrative to follow. But otherwise, you take that out, this movie, when you take scene by scene, it's hilarious.
It's great.
But you could just, you could have each one of the scenes as a sketch and it would work. Like it's, I think that 8.5 is 8.5 pantograms.
Surely it should be giant barbecues that you are being sacrificed on.
Yeah. Well, again, that's that, you know, that sequence being taken out. It was in the work print cut that you watched. So it's, I think this movie is in a special place for a lot of people. You know, a lot of people love this movie for the same reason. It's something they watch as tweens or teenagers. You know, it's a slumber party movie for sure. Should I say slumber party again? Pronounce it correctly.
Do you want to do it again?
Slumber. It's a slumber party. I'm leaving all of this in. All right. I'm leaving all of it in. It's a slumber party movie, you know, and it's an 8.5. It's an 8.5 pentagrams. I highly recommend it to anyone that hasn't seen it for whatever reason. So you can, if you join the camp of people that rated this at 57, whatever the fuck percent on IMDb, take us off your playlist. Right? Go. We don't want you.
Or just tell people to listen to us anyway, even to hate us.
No, unless we can change your mind.
And I thought I was bad. I was freaking hungover. Yeah,
you sound like you had a stroke. I fucking swam here. What's your excuse?
Hangover.
And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Ricky.
Hey!
Bye.
I love this podcast. I mean street. I mean neighborhood.
Oh, fuck.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood. A beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? It's a neighborly day in this beauty wood. A neighborly day for a beauty. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you. So let's make the most of this beautiful day. Since we're together, we might as well say, would you be mine? Could you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor? Won't you please? Won't you please? Please won't you be my neighbor?